there are so many Catholic saints. Did you know there's a Saint Noel and a Saint Benjamin?
Are you kidding me, Ben?
I am not kidding you.
What is Saint Noel the saint of?
I don't have his patron saint information here, but I do know that he was a Jesuit saint, and I thought it was cool. Sometimes for my friends, I search out saints with similar names, which is not how you decide which, you know, saint is your saint, mm-hmm. I guess. I just thought it was neat that there was a Benjamin and a Noel.
Both of whom were martyred, correct?
Both of whom were martyred.
Do you have to be martyred to become a saint? Is that like a requirement?
I want to say no, but I am not myself Catholic.
No, nor am I, but I did learn something very interesting today. There are several flavors of martyr. Did you know this?
Yes.
There's the proto-martyr, who is like the first martyr in a given region. Then there's the great martyr, which is like a martyr who was martyred under the most nasty of circumstances, yeah, like yeah. involving torture and, you know, consternation. You know, Jesus would have been a great martyr, you know,
yeah.
that kind of treatment. And that brings us to today's story, which is about fairy tales.
Yes. For anyone curious about the Saint Benjamin, it is a deacon. He's a deacon and a martyr as well in Persia, and he died from merciless torture.
Also a great martyr, perhaps.
Perhaps, yeah. But hopefully we're not torturing our super producer, Casey Pegram.
I just want to give a shout out to Proto Martyr, fantastic band.
So good. I was listening to them today.
Yeah.
Kind of sound like Nick Cave meets Wire.
Sure.
And yeah. a little bit of like Television kind of thrown in there. Really, really cool.
Yeah.
Highly recommend Excellent checking band. Them out as well. Good rec, Casey. Good rec. Casey on the case.
So if you are a fan of this show, odds are that you, like us, are fascinated by fairy tales. I did a lot of research in a different life into the origin of fairy tales, which I'm sure everybody knows. The origins of fairy tales are much more dark and grisly than the Disney adaptations that you see today. Our subject today concerns a fairy tale that's very well known, popularized, perhaps by Disney's Tangled film, and that is the story of Rapunzel, the trope of a princess locked in a tower who's got a ton of long hair.
It's so cool, Ben, because a lot of these stories that you're talking about that had very grisly roots had even grislier roots before Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm got their hands on them and kind of sanitized them, cleaned them up a little bit. Because oftentimes the story that led to the story was just unbearably grisly, as we're going to get into today. And then when you get to stuff like Tangled, another step removed from the Grimm brothers, it's even further sanitized. With Rapunzel, it turns out that the origins of the story of the aforementioned long-haired princess locked in a tower goes back to pagan times.
Yeah, yeah.
Under pagan Rome.
It goes back to several different places for sure. A lot of fairy tales kind of borrow things from a lot of earlier similar pre-existing stories. That's why the princess locked in a tower is a trope that occurs in more than one place. But this story does have a real-life incident that happens in pagan Rome. It concerns someone who became known as Saint Barbara. According to the legend, Barbara was the daughter of a wealthy man living in the 3rd century in a place called Nicomedia, which is part of modern-day Turkey. Her father was super protective and was very, very concerned that the evil influences of the outside world would corrupt his daughter, lead to her ruination and debauchment. So he locked her in a tower. And this gave Barbara a lot of time to think. So over her period of isolation, according to the story, let me amend that, this is a legend, she became convinced that the pagan gods of Rome weren't all they were cracked up to be?
Yeah, Ben, I actually saw a version of the story where a Catholic priest crept in through the window and like schooled her on Catholicism. Because my question is, if all she knew was the pagan ways,
mm-hmm.
how is she going to all of a sudden have a grasp of Christianity?
Right. That's a great plot hole to point out. The story where she encounters an agent of the Christian God rather than just realizing the Christian God says that the priest, was a Catholic, and snuck into her chamber, get this, disguised as a doctor, and that he kept coming, and over time, he taught her the Catholic faith and eventually baptized her.
That's right. There are other versions of the story that don't mention the priest at all, that imply that she was just sort of immaculately gifted with the understanding of the Trinity. And this goes back to this idea of her window arrangement in that tower, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because the story says that originally her father locked her in a tower that had two windows, but when she converted to Christianity, regardless of how she did it, she installed a third window in the tower to symbolize, not a stunning plot twist, the Holy Trinity.
Yeah, because all that time up there alone, she kind of figured out masonry too, right?
Yeah, and how to make windows.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, with like what tools exactly? There's another version of the story where while her father was away, he had workmen that were doing some improvements on the land or maybe even installing the windows in the first place, and that she asked them to put in a third window. Mm-hmm. And then when the father returned and saw this third window, he questioned, he said, "Daughter, what gives?"
And she
and she copped to her newfound faith.
At which point she said, "Father, I am a Christian now," at which point he drew a sword to kill her immediately. But she used the power of prayer and created an opening in the wall and then teleported, essentially. She was magically transported, or I guess in this case you would say miraculously transported, to a mountain gorge, and two shepherds saw her arrive.
Yeah. So let's take a step back, if you're okay with this, Ben. Let's pick up the kind of more grisly version, the grim version of the Rapunzel story that many people may be unfamiliar with. Do you remember a show that was broadcast on Nickelodeon in the mid-90s, early 90s even, that was called Grimm's Fairy Tale Classics?
Yes.
So it was a Japanese-produced anime series. I think there were like 12 episodes, and I think it was distributed in America by Haim Saban of Power Rangers fame. And the thing I most remember is that the versions of the stories in this cartoon were the pretty weird, messed up versions. In the grim version of the Rapunzel story, it starts with a married couple. The wife is pregnant, and she demands some lettuces from this garden, this fenced-in garden that belongs to an enchantress. Other versions say that she's like a medicine woman that has the power to use herbs to heal or to hurt.
Harm, right? Or an evil witch.
Exactly. And so she finally convinces her husband to go in and get her this. It's rampion is one thing, and also Rapunzel, another name for this kind of root vegetable. You can make a salad out of the leaves. And the witch eventually catches him because he goes back, and she agrees not to murder him on sight. But in that classic fairy tale trope, he has to surrender his firstborn child.
Mm-hmm.
That was this the cause of all of this in the first place, right?
Well, in her defense, she also, in addition to sparing his life, says, "I'll give you all the herbs you want."
That's right.
So there's another plus.
But the irony is that the wife only is craving these herbs because, or the vegetables, because she's pregnant.
Right.
And that's a big part of the story too.
So he agrees, and fast forward to the time that the child is born. A girl named Rapunzel. Oh, the evil witch, by the way, in many versions of the story is named Dame Gothel. How gothic is that?
Super.
And Dame Gothel, upon the child's birth, takes her to raise as her own, and she actually gives her the name Rapunzel. And Rapunzel grows up to be a real looker. She is the most beautiful child in the world with long golden hair. But as soon as she turns 12, the witch or enchantress locks her up inside a tower in the middle of nowhere in the woods. There are no stairs. There's no door. There's just one room and one window. And the way that the witch visits her is by using her hair as rope. So that's where we get the famous line, "Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair so that I may climb thy golden stair." Or just a shout out to perhaps the more popular modern version. Casey, we were talking about this off air. Could you guys think we could play a clip of that line without getting sued? Perfect. Perfect. So that's not the the original line is thy golden stare.
And that's, of course, the Beastie Boys from the incredible album Paul's Boutique.
And this is how Rapunzel's life is set to be for the rest of her life. As you can imagine, she's pretty bored in this tower. She amuses herself in a number of ways, combing her incredibly long hair.
Possibly learning about masonry.
Possibly learning masonry, singing to herself, building windows.
Whatever.
But singing is the key.
Singing is the key because the handsome prince, of course, has got to be a handsome prince, hears this mellifluous singing and comes a-calling, and then she lets down the hair. He doesn't even know. Well, I don't know. It's unclear to me. How does he get up there in the first place? He doesn't know how to ask for the hair.
He stalks her.
Oh, wait a minute. He does know because he's overheard the witch doing it. He stalked her at this point. Yeah that's not creepy at all.
He keeps coming back to listen to the singing. He's like, what's going on? I'm so interested.
Presumably, he even impersonates the voice of the witch to get her to let down the hair in the first place. And then all of a sudden he appears to her and she's like, whoa, who's this jabroni coming in through my window trying to pretend to be my grandmama? Because at this point she thinks the witch is like her family. She doesn't remember her parents. And they get it on.
Right. Eventually he continues to visit her. The number of visits depends on the version you read. And eventually the prince asks Rapunzel to make an honest man of him and they agree to get married. And they say, okay, next step is that we have to figure out how to get you the heck out of here. So they say, look, we know when Dame Gothel, the enchantress or evil witch, comes by. So every time the witch comes by, I'll be out of sight, out of mind, but I'll visit you in the night. And when I visit you, I will bring you a piece of silk. And I won't bring it all at once. I'll just visit you night after night, bring in a piece of silk. And then you will naturally make a ladder out of it because she has also acquired that particular skill or craft. But something goes wrong.
Well, you know, as things are wont to do in the fairy tale world, the witch overhears this plan, while the prince is away, she goes up there, confronts Rapunzel, lobs off her hair with a butcher's knife or like a pair of scissors or whatever, depending on the version, and then sends her away into the wilderness.
Yes. In the first edition of the Grimm Fairy Tales version, she says to the witch, without knowing exactly what she's saying, that her dress is growing tighter around her waist, which is an allusion to pregnancy.
That's right.
And the witch catches on, and then in the second edition, she cuts off Rapunzel's hair, throws her out in the woods. The prince comes calling that night, and the evil witch lets down the hair that she has cut off. He climbs up. You know, we can imagine he's looking forward to spending some time with his fiancée. And to his utter and abject horror, he meets the witch instead of Rapunzel. And she says, you're never going to see that girl again. She throws him from the tower, which I think in most versions of the story, he ends up hitting a thorn bush and he goes blind.
Yeah, they poke his eyes out. And that's the thing, dude. In that anime version I was telling you about, it does that. It has that happen. And it's sort of like, it's not like bloody or like, you know, scarred, weird, gouged out eyes or anything, but he's kind of got like red, patchy kind of scratch marks all over his eyes and they're sort of like closed, you know? Mm-hmm. And then he also wanders the wilderness and eventually hears that singing that he liked so well and realizes that it's Rapunzel. And she has given birth to twin boys, I believe, according to the Grimm version. And then she cries tears of joy into his eye holes, and he is cured, and the sight is restored to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as much trials and tribulations they go through, it does ultimately end up with them all living together. He takes her back to his kingdom because he can see now and find his way back, and they all live happily ever after.
There's a Rogaine moment in some versions of the story, too, because when he can see again, he touches her head and her hair magically grows back.
Just like Zoop.
Yep. And the evil witch, when she throws the guy out of the tower, she ends up dropping Rapunzel's hair somehow and it leaves her trapped in the tower. But this, you know how we're talking about the amalgamated origin of what we call modern fairy tales. We do know that Rapunzel itself has, at least the Grimm's version, does have a more recent than Roman times influence, a story called Petrosinella, or Parsley, written by a guy named Giambattista Basile in his collection of fairy tales in 1634.
Interesting.
And it's kind of the same, but it's a little more R-rated because the encounters between the prince and Rapunzel are much more explicit and sexual.
A little more steamy.
Yeah, it's a little more graphic, a little more late night Skinamax
at
the time.
Yeah, indeed. And in the grim version, the sex is simply implied by the baby bump.
Mm-hmm, by the tightening waist. So back to St. Barbara. Did she have hair long enough to let someone climb up a tower using it? Could someone climb up a tower using anyone's hair? In St. Barbara's case, the hair is not as important.
Not
it's
really
not really
the
there
at all.
Yeah,
no,
it's just like you assume she has some hair.
She presumably had a bob cut, a pixie cut.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So when we last left Barbara, her father, who in this version of the story is named Dioscorus, pursues his daughter, somehow finds this magic mountain gorge, and then he's like, where is she? Where is she? And the first shepherd says, I don't know, don't talk to me. But the second betrays her, and for doing this, this shepherd gets turned to stone, and all the sheep in his flock are turned to locust. And because of this betrayal, Dioscorus does find his daughter, and he decides, what, Noel, not to kill her himself?
That's right. Well, at least at that moment. But yeah, he felt like she deserved, her day in kangaroo court.
Right. Which means that she was dragged before the prefect of the province, a guy named Martinaeus.
Yeah, and this is where it really starts to get ugly. The court, I guess you could call it, beat her mercilessly and beat her with pieces of rawhide on her back. They rubbed her wounds with what you'd call a fur cloth, I guess, just to kind of exacerbate the pain. And at night, she, according to this legend or story, she prayed to what's referred to in this article from OCA.org as the heavenly bridegroom and Jesus, the Savior. And according to the story of this martyrdom, her wounds were spontaneously healed. And then when they found her healed, they beat her and brutalized her even more.
Yeah, they started to use torches to burn her or attempt to. Those torches went out when they were getting close to her body. And they kept trying to torture her. She kept healing through the power of prayer. OCA, by the way, is the Orthodox Church in America website, which is a great resource for stories of saints. Eventually, they say, well, look, she's not going to renounce her Christian faith. She's obviously, for some reason, healing very quickly. So they eventually decide that they are going to kill her. In one version of the story, they say, okay, well, let's see you heal from a beheading.
Yeah.
In another version, the torture continues to where her body is raked, wounded with hooks. She's led naked through the city as people mock her.
Yikes.
Then she is eventually beheaded.
By
her father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this version of the story that we're reading is from this religious site. So it's kind of presented as fact. It's clearly one version of the story that incorporates some of these mystical religious elements.
Mm-hmm.
And an added element of comeuppance, her father and the prefect were apparently struck by lightning, brought on by the wrath of God, and instantly killed.
What goes around comes around, right? This story continued because, as is the case with so many saints, relics of her body remained. And in the 6th century, the relics of this great martyr, Barbara, because as you said, Noel, there are different types of martyrs, the relics of the saint were transferred to Constantinople, and then they stayed there for 600 years before they were transferred to Kiev by a daughter of the Byzantine Emperor Alexius Komnenos, who was also named Barbara. And that is where these relics rest today, at Kiev's St. Vladimir Cathedral, where an akathist to the saint is served each Tuesday.
And here's the thing. The Orthodox Church is largely what holds this martyrdom in such high esteem. The because of some of the scarcity of real historical records about this, she actually was taken off the list of martyrs and saints in 1969 by the Roman Catholic Church.
It's true. It's absolutely true. But there's pretty compelling evidence that this story, this princess in a tower trope, did lend some inspiration to the story that we now know as Rapunzel. And of course, if you have seen Tangled, a lot of this stuff was cut out of this story. And have you seen Tangled, Noel?
I have not,
but I'm going to go out on a limb and say there probably wasn't a beheading.
No, I'm pretty sure not. But again, even in that, I was pretty traumatized by that anime version where the prince gets his eyes gouged out by thorns, even that being the sort of more sanitized version.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense. The Grimm brothers were essentially historians, and they collected oral tradition of all of these hundreds, I believe, of folk tales that they then used as inspiration for their Grimm's fairy tales.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these older folk tales, from an academic perspective or a folkloric perspective, are immensely and endlessly fascinating because they provide a window into the realities of the time. Because in the early versions of stories that would later inspire this fairy tale or the Grimm version of the fairy tale, a lot more emphasis is put on the idea of pregnancy and the use of plants as medicinal aids for pregnant women or for people when they give birth. And the problem is that this was a very dangerous time in a woman's life, because, and still is, you know, it was such a dangerous time because there were many, many complications that could result in injury or death to the mother or the child. So this worry of having to trust someone who is doing things that seem inexplicable.
That's right.
Or hence supernatural.
Yeah, exactly.
Is a salient and immediate fear.
I mean, it's often a sign of witchcraft or seen as such when a woman is close to nature and understands how to harness some of these herbs in ways that the average layperson does not, and that is looked upon with suspicion. And it's almost that thing where making a bargain with a woman like this, you're sort of rolling the dice because you don't know if she is there to heal or to harm, and you know that she potentially has the power to do either, and you have to trust her, right, to do that. So it's sort of, it's kind of personifying that inherent paranoia that comes along with putting your fate in the hands of another person who you're not really sure of their motives, I guess, right?
Yeah, or you don't trust, right?
Sure.
And as I believe I mentioned in an earlier episode, man, what a terrible gig to be a healer back in that time, because even if you did your best and something went wrong, people would decide you were a witch. There's one interesting thing that we have to mention, right? To me, the most fascinating thing about saints is that they're often called the patron saint of one thing or another. And Barbara, this might surprise some people to learn, is the patron saint of armorers, artillerymen, architects, mathematicians, miners, and the Italian Navy, the whole thing.
And if I'm not mistaken, that comes from the idea in the story that her abusers were struck dead by lightning. Because when you're a miner, you're often subject to cave-ins and even explosions from combustible minerals and things like that. And the idea that St. Barbara would protect you from lightning or from those kind of pitfalls of that profession, right?
Yep, absolutely. She's venerated by Catholics who face the danger of sudden and violent death at work as well. And her name is invoked against thunder and lightning and all accidents arising from explosions of gunpowder. An interesting side note, the Spanish word Santa Barbara and the corresponding word Santa Barbara signify the powder magazine of a ship or a fortress. And back in the day, it used to be standard operating procedure to have a statue of this saint at the magazine to protect the structure from suddenly exploding. So there's the more you know star flying over my head.
And Santa Barbara, California, which is on the coast, has a lot of oil and gas fields. And of course, Santa Barbara is Spanish for Saint Barbara.
Fascinating. And now we have to ask ourselves, what other secrets do modern fairy tales or modern versions of fairy tales hold for us here in 2019? We'd like to hear your story about your favorite fairy tale secrets. I'd also like to, before we close out the show, give a shout out to a new follower I have on Twitter that just made my day. I think Casey, Noel, I think you'll both enjoy this. Somebody made a Twitter account called Ridiculous History Out of Context, where they just take quotes or interactions from us and post them without explaining where they came from or what they pertain to.
What? We have a joke Twitter account?
We do, and I don't know who does it. I assume you're listening. I just wanted to say thanks.
So we've arrived.
If you want to follow them at @outridiculous. On Twitter.
Yeah. I really just do the Instagram thing. You can follow me at Embryonic Insider.
You can follow me at Ben Bolin. You can also meet the best part of this show, your fellow listeners, on our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians. Big thanks, as always, to super producer Casey Pegram. Casey, I've got to look up saints and see which one you might identify with. I'll get back to you over the weekend.
Big thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Thanks to Gabe Luzier, our research assistant, associate, whatever you want to call him. He is the stuff.
A genuine gem, that guy. Gabe is an absolute gift. We have some things coming up for you, so stay tuned. We might have some special guests in the mix. We might have the return of Christopher Hasiotis.
That's right. And in the meantime, we would love it very much if you would say nice things about the show on iTunes or your podcast platform of choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, they'll say that you're supposed to call it Apple Podcasts now, but don't let them fool you.
You can call it whatever you want. You know what we mean.
Yeah.
See you next time, folks.